The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 212, January 29th, 2010. My name is Jim Race. I'm here with Jules Cisek, and we're going to talk bikes and all sorts of bikes. How you doing, Jules?
Good. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
So we've got a really cool show for you guys today. We have kind of a wrap-up of the car, because we talked to Toby Moody, who has just returned from Argentina. And then we also talked to Simon Pavey, who is a motorcyclist over in Wales. And he runs a school, and he's done a bunch of Dakars, and he's really famous for both helping Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman learn how to ride off-road for their long way round trip, and then he also went with Charlie Borman on the Race of the Car. So
yeah, that segment that they did when they were training for Long Way Around is probably one of the funniest.
Yeah.
Funny bits. You know, it's an opportunity to see both, you know, Lewin and Charlie take endless tumbles, practicing on the muddy hillsides.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll hear from those guys later on. And we also have Azhar Hussain from the TTXGP. He has a really crazy idea for the TTXGP rules. And I know you totally geeked out, and I think you were one of the first people that actually signed up for this. So why don't you tell us about it, Jim?
Well, what they put together, which is really, you're right, it's really bizarre, because rules are typically laid down by rules for international or national series or hell, local series are usually laid out by a very select group of people, and they're in some ways typically sort of arbitrary, although, you know, they're hopefully based on logic. But instead, in this way, they're using a wiki, which is, for those of you that don't know and aren't, you know, fully geeked out, as you say, it's a collaborative tool to develop a framework of definition for whatever, you know, body of knowledge you want to put together. I mean, I think most people that are online know about Wikipedia, hopefully.
Certainly all the people that sent in their calendar entries.
Exactly. So they're going to use that, and they're accepting input from teams, racers, fans, whoever. Now, granted, there is an arbiter, Harry Mullen, who's he's been following the TTXGP for quite some time, and will, you know, he's going to be the guy that kind of vets the ideas as they go along. So it's nice to actually have a czar over the whole thing, but it's cool. I'm impressed by the forward-looking aspect of it. It's just yet another thing that's kind of on the edge. You know, electric bikes themselves are already kind of on the edge. Using a tool like this is just very interesting.
It is. And we'll hear more from him, and we'll have a link to in the show notes. So you guys go ahead and, you know, sign up and start making rules.
Indeed. Yeah, jump in. Don't be shy.
Okay. And then we have one bit of listener email from two different people that wrote in, and there's a little funny bit at the end about this, but Lawrence Soma and Ed Hazer wrote in about a documentary called Love, Speed, and Loss. And now that I actually – it's just funny because now that I just read this out loud from the notes, mm-hmm. we did mention this thing on the movies episode.
We just didn't roll it into the –
just didn't roll into the page for some reason. But anyway, what's funny is that this is when Jim started this – thread in right on two about the movies. Once we talked about it on the show, that was in his first post. He mentioned this exact film, which is, you know, Love, Speed, and Loss. It's a documentary, and But now it's also available online for free. So that's, I guess, the reason why we decided to include it. But
it's a very touching flick, frankly. As I mentioned to you before we were talking on the show, I'm like, it's very retro, you know, because it's, you know, hand shot stuff from the period, but with some great current narration, and definitely worth checking out, and definitely, hell, worth checking out for free at any cost, if you will.
Right. Okay, so we finally tallied up all the Writers of the Decade results.
How many did we get all together?
We got 39 responses.
Okay.
I wish we could have gotten a bunch more, but this is plenty to have a nice statistical, you know, breakdown. And you know, the results aren't super surprising, so we're not going to like spend too much time on it. I think we actually spend more time on at the bottom of this list than at the top. You know. But I did want to shout out two honorable mentions to Ian Jemmett, who sent a really interesting spreadsheet where he like broke down how he arrived at his answers.
And thanks so much for that, Ian. I'm amazed at the little gems that we get from listeners sometimes. They will just surprise us with the coolest stuff where it's clear that they've gone way out of their way to provide it to, you know, to give us something that's bitchin', and it's little surprises like that. They're just way cool. Anyway.
While I'm saying that, I should also mention that we got a lot of really interesting comments about why people picked, you know, certain writers, and those were fascinating to read. So thank you very much, you guys, for that. And the other honorable mention goes to Stuart Fraser and his dad, Wes, who actually like had a, and I didn't realize this, Jim. I didn't realize this actually until I was making the notes just before the show. But you actually got left off the CC list later on in that conversation. It was hilarious. You guys provided so much entertainment, because Stuart was like defending his statistical analysis with his dad, who is a big stat geek or something. So anyway, it was fast. It was just really fun. And so thanks, guys. It was great. The list, you know, starts with a very, very big surprise, which is, of course, that Valentino Rossi was mentioned 39 times out of all 39.
Out of 39.
Yeah. Huge surprise. But then, you know, then it was a long way to the next person, which was a tie between Lorenzo and Stono. He each got 28 mentions. Pedrosa in third was very surprising. He was on my list, but a lot of people, I think, have still in a very much love-hate relationship with Pedrosa.
Yeah.
And our first surprise, I think, came in fourth, which is Capirossi and Gibernau. I'm not surprised to see Gibernau up there, but it's great to see Capirossi that highly regarded, because I think he totally deserves it. I mean, especially considering that he has been absolutely present during that decade.
But... I think one of the things too that we should bring up is that the demographic of the people that responded. You can basically tell from the email addresses and you know, where people are from. So it's the same way all the time. Whenever we solicit feedback, it's from all over the place. And so I just want to point that out. I don't think it skews the results. I think it evens the results.
Exactly. No, it's good. I mean, we do have a bit of a American contingent, but yeah, we had some. I mean, we had a lot of replies from all over.
Yep.
Okay, so then we have in fifth. I was a little bit surprised that Biagi made it, just because he's so disliked by a lot of racing fans, but.
He was on my list.
He totally deserves it. I mean, he's on my list too. And by the way, we sucked in a couple of lists, like Toby Moody's list. We solicited a list from David Emmett and Scott Jones from Motor Matters. But everyone was counted equal. It's all fair. sixth place was Bayless, and I think he probably would have been a lot higher I think there were a lot of lists that was very specifically limited to MotoGP. My own was, for example.
Right.
And some people decided to go outside, just basically talk about all road racers, and some people even included off-road.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or Dupre. Yeah. Both of you were my list. We kind of stuck to the original formula, yeah. But there were others that not only included people from outside the MotoGP world, but people from not even clearly in the last decade.
Seventh place, Hayden. Nicky Hayden. Yay. He was not on my list, but he was on my – he would have been 11th on yeah. my list. But it was nice to see he got 17 responses. So that's already less than half.
Yeah.
Then Edwards in eighth with 16.
Which probably would make him mad because he should be three spots up, shouldn't he?
Yes, that's right. That was the funniest comment actually in all of it was yours. And all the responses when I say, hey, send me your list, and you sent it in, and you had, I think you had Edwards sixth, and you said, you know what, I'm gonna make him fifth. That was brilliant.
Sorry, Colin.
Okay, and then tied for ninth, 3-way tie between Melandri, Matt Mladen, and Ben Spies, which is so appropriate that the Mladen and Spies are tied there.
Yeah.
And of course, it's great to see that Melandri was up there. People really, I think, appreciate the fact that he was able to kind of bounce back from the Ducati mess. He's obviously back. So
there were two comeback kids this year for completely different reasons. Marcos was a season long one. And the guy that's, one of the guys that's tied for second in this top 10 was as well for completely different reasons. So
you mean Stoner?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Roll on.
Then we've got Haga. Not surprisingly, a lot of people just basically wrote in, just love watching him ride, which is, yep. I totally 100% agree.
And another guy that we like to watch ride that is, as far as I know, not riding this year.
Yeah.
And that's Gary McCoy.
Gary McCoy in 11th, yeah. A lot of people mentioned him. A lot of people wrote in about him. Yeah, it's a bummer.
Yeah. Iron Man.
12th place is Alex Barros. Then in 13th, we got a tie between Kenny Roberts Jr. and Dajiro Kato, which is great to see that he got the mentions that he did. Because he was unfortunately taken away from us before he really got to show us his potential.
And just what a magic personality, both on the track and off it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yep.
And then we've got Abe, who got four mentions. John McGuinness, who got four mentions, obviously for his incredible run at the Isle of Man.
Here's where it gets weird.
Yeah. Then we got a four-way tie between Ricky Carmichael, Alex Crivier, Miguel Duhamel, and Stefan Everett. So I think Crivier was basically done by the year 2000. So it's kind of he's kind of like a leftover. Somebody also sent in Doohan and Fogarty further below.
I don't think Crivier even made it all the way through the 2000 season, did he?
I don't think he did, but he was there. I think he did half season or something. But anyway, we have Carmichael and Everett. So obviously, we start getting a little further away from road racing here.
And we're talking couple of votes for each of those guys.
Yeah, just two. But it's cool that we got them. Somebody out there was like, hey, if we're going to talk about riders, you gotta have Carmichael there.
He's
unbelievable in motocross. You gotta have Everett's there, and then we have a lot of single mentions like Ben Bostrom, Shaky Byrne got a mention, which is cool. Troy Corser, David Knight, who is a enduro racer that's very well known in Europe, but in America you probably never even heard his name.
Yeah.
Then of course we got Cyril Dupre, who just won the Dakar. Randy DePugna got a mention. Then Doohan, which I think that was basically a crossover there from the 90s.
And then
Joey Dunlop.
Who would have to be, frankly, at the top of the list if for me, if we were going to talk about, you know, writers of the century.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. The other boss from Eric Fogarty, David Jeffries, obviously another great writer who unfortunately lost his life in the Isle of Man.
Mm-hmm.
And Guy Martin, woohoo. Thank you for sending in Guy Martin, because he is quite, he's awesome.
Yep. So that was the people that were being sent in. For me, after a while, that kind of started becoming second to what people were saying about them. It was like each entry that you guys were sending in was a little story.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was awesome. And it, you know, maybe I'm over gushing about the feedback we get from you guys, but please talk to us. I mean, it's fun. It's what drives us to talk back to you.
Yeah. Except for Martin.
No.
Yeah, I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. Actually, I really want to give Martin a special thanks because he's the one who hooked us up with Simon Pavey. So,
yeah.
Martin, big thumbs up on that one. And we love hearing from you, especially when you're writing from your iPhone. This is, well, sorry, to everybody else. It's kind of all inside crap. Anyway.
Hey, it's Jules Cheesek from MotoGPOD. I'm here with the Sultan of Sand, the multinational matador, as Robbie, Floyd liked to call you, versus Toby Moody. How's it going,
I never
Toby?
Heard that. I only heard that from you sending me emails. The Sultan of Sand. I'll never be the Sultan of Swing like Mark Knopfler is, but there we go.
There were quite many more, but those were the ones that I remembered that stuck in my head.
Funny. Yes, all back now, and I got back on the Tuesday morning after the rally. Overnight flight, long flight from Buenos Aires back to Europe. Bounced in Sao Paulo, not allowed to get off the plane, so 17 hours on the paraffin budgie. And happy to be home, and I slept for 13 hours the first night, so I was a bit weary, but that's what you do on that rally, you just blitz it and then just collapse.
Yeah, so how long were you there? Because you arrived earlier and you left after, right?
Yeah, I got there on the 28th, so I left the UK on the 27th, the afternoon, evening of the 27th, and I returned on the Tuesday after the rally. So you've got to be there in advance because there's 3 days of scrutineering, you've got to acclimatise. It's only a three-hour time difference. That's not a problem, but, you know, you're a bit bashed about after a transatlantic. And you've got to get everything all into your head and prepare. And then the rally is 2 weeks and a bit.
Yep.
And it finishes on the Sunday, and then you fly back on Monday, and you get back home on the Tuesday, and all of a sudden it's three and a bit weeks. That's what happens.
And this is the third time you covered Dakar?
Seventh.
Okay, really?
Yeah, I did five in Africa, and I've done both of the Argentina-Chile ones. So I did 2000, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 2009, 2010, in South America.
Oh, so you took a break in between it. That's probably why it wasn't where you did that before. Wow.
Yeah. So I've done seven. So I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
Nice. So which is cool because like last year you had there was a lot of kind of trepidation about the whole Eurosport thing, and you ended up with a pretty full plate. Like I have on my list, like you did Dakar, mm-hmm. you did all the Eurosport stuff for the MotoGP. Some of it was on location, some of it was, I guess, from the studio in England?
Yeah, some of it was on location, some of it was from the studio in the UK because of budgetary constraints, and some of them I wasn't involved with because I had other things pre-booked because it was such a last-minute deal.
Right.
So that's shook out that way. But you're right, the season filled up. I worked at Le Mans 24 Hours once more. I was working at Monaco Formula One. I was working at Silverstone F1.
Well, you did the Indy track announcing.
did the indie track announcing when I last saw you. That's correct. So that was you know, great fun. That was a long day, hard work, but it's going to be good, and I'm going to be going back there. So that's positive news for late August. Going to be going back there and helping the guys out at IMS. And I got all sorts of ideas of what we can build on from 2009 and take them forward to 2010. So yeah, really looking forward to it. Really looking forward to it. Be great to, now that I've got the knowledge of and the experience of last time.
Have you done that kind of event, like the indie announcing event, before?
I've done track announcing, you know, PA live trackside announcing. That's really where I started. You know, hill climbing and circuits and such like.
Gotcha.
But I hadn't actually done it for a while. But it's quite humbling, if that's the word, when you're standing on in the pit lane, on the bricks, on the podium with Mary Holman George, and you're talking through the wireless microphone, and you can hear your own voice reverberating back through the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and you're thinking, that's pretty cool, that. You get goosebumps, no matter how much experience you've got the world over. That's pretty cool when you can hear your own voice at IMS. You know, it is a mecca. It is a mecca. I mean, working with the guys who are upstairs in the booth, they said, well, this is how we do it. We talk for a bit and we might let it breathe for 30 seconds. We talk for a bit and might let it breathe for 45 seconds. And as you know, with the television coverage that we do over here, it's a lot more Gatling gun over here.
Yeah.
With motorcycle racing and motorsport, because it is a Gatling gun kind of sport. Tennis, cricket, maybe football, it's a bit more staccato. But I said, listen, you know, how do you want me to commentate? And it wrong-footed me almost for the first half of the Friday afternoon, because, well, don't you want me to commentate all the time? No, we just do it like this. And that's quite different for me, but I wanted to cater for the local audience. But in the end, we found a balance, and they said, I think by Sunday, they said, I'll just go for it.
Very nice, very nice.
You know, and it seemed to work. So yeah, it was great fun, great fun. It seemed a long time ago, but it was great fun being there.
So that's definitely in the bag for this year?
Yes.
Sweet.
Yes. I mean, the last bits of, I don't know, a couple of things, but we've had some email communication. So, yeah, that'll be on the cards. That'll be great.
Awesome. And you also did Day of Champions last year?
Day of Champions, both sides of the Atlantic. Yes, we have one on the Thursday before the British Grand Prix. And then I was helping out on the Friday morning at Indianapolis, which was great. And presumably there'll be another one. I should know, but I can't believe that there won't be another one. So there'll be another one, and get all the MotoGP riders up there and a few other people. Great.
Cool. And then one thing I heard is that I know you're very, very into this whole hill climb thing. You set some kind of a record this year, didn't you?
Yeah, I started hill climbing That's where I started commentating. Hill climbing over here is yes, it's like Pikes Peak, but without the peak, without the gravel road, and without the 10-mile record to be broken. Hill climbing over in the UK can only take place on private roads, on private land. So by definition, you can't close the Queen's Highway to have a hill climb on, such as you can do in Europe.
Gotcha.
So they're short, sharp, asphalt surface roads, and they are maybe a mile in length maximum, which might not sound very long. It isn't very long, but it's the 100-meter sprint of motorsport, and the hill climb down the road is where I've started commentating. My folks used to drive. My mum was very quick driver herself. My father was quick as well, racing circuits as well. And finally, I had the opportunity to get into a car and drive it a couple of years ago. And then that bloke who owned the car sold it, but then we managed to buy it back. We did very well in 2008 with the car, and we made some adjustments and with some shock absorbers and made it go quickly. And then we put another engine in it for 2009, another 600cc bike engine in it. And I wanted to get the record at one place, and I did, which was Shelsley, which is the oldest motorsport venue that's still on its original venue in the world. Got that, hugely historical venue. And then I managed to get the record at another place, and the guy who I share the car with got a record at another place. So we've done very well. We've done very well.
Fantastic, fantastic. So this really is like I think we're talking about like 29 seconds or something like that.
Yeah, Shelsley is my record now is a 28.8.
28.8. Wow.
Yeah. But you know, you're still doing 0-60 in well under 4 seconds, even in the car that I've got. Power to weight ratio of the car that I've got, which is a single seater carbon fiber wings and slicks car, the power to weight ratio with 240 kilos is 565 horsepower per ton.
Whoa. Nice.
So it's, you know, it's not a MotoGP bike, but it's pretty nippy.
Very cool. Very cool.
And it's personally a little landmark that I wanted to do, and the opportunity was there, so I did it.
Well, congrats. That's really cool. I saw a lot of photos of your helmet and your gloves and stuff like that on Facebook, but I didn't realize that you were actually competing and making these records. So just heard about that recently.
No, it's. I think we went out every year. Every time we went out with the car this year at three venues for about 5 or 6 different times. We won the class every time between us and eventually got the record at all three venues between us. So it was very good. We have had some great fun. It's quite nice. I'm sure it's quite nice when we talk about motorsport and we're fans of motorsport, we dream about, oh, I wish I could win something one day. Well, in my little world, I won a little something. So I'm happy, you know.
Exactly. That's awesome. Awesome.
It's just a little class win and a little record, but that's all that I wanted to do, and I got it. So it was great fun, and we had a couple of beers. So
nice, yeah. Very cool, very cool. All right, so let's talk about Dakar this year. Basically, we're doing a show today about kind of wrapping up the whole Dakar experience. Tell me what is it like to be out there. You're basically living the same life as a lot of the drivers and riders. Are you staying in a tent? Are you staying in a hotel? What's it like for you?
You're in the army. When you're working on the Dakar, you are essentially similar to working in the army. It's a regime. It's a routine. There's no glamour. You're there to do a job, do it well, full stop. Personally, there is no choice of staying in a hotel once we leave Buenos Aires. You stay in a tent. Suits me fine. You can go to bed when you want. You get up very early in the morning. Sometimes we're leaving at 4 o'clock. Leaving. Wow. And when they say leave, they won't quite leave you behind. They can't leave you behind. But if you are late, you don't do yourself any favors. So if you're getting up at that hour, you know, you got to go to bed at 8 o'clock at night. And sometimes I'm still voicing at 8 o'clock at night, helping out the Versus program. So you have to catnap as and when you can. And some days you are absolutely worn out. And other days you feel full of energy and whatever. You have to pace yourself. And it takes a while to pace yourself to make sure that you run out of energy, like running out of fuel, just as you cross the finish line.
Right, right, right. And do you bounce around from bivouac to bivouac, like locations by helicopter? Do you drive?
No, nothing so glamorous as rock star as going in a helicopter. If we leave at 4 o'clock in the morning from one bivouac and we need to travel 600 miles to the next bivouac, we will jump on a bus at 4 o'clock. We'll go to a local airstrip, airport, air whatever. We jump on an aeroplane, whether or not it's a Hercules C-130 or another military plane of either the Argentine or the Chilean Air Force. That then flies us 1 hour. We land at another airstrip, jump on another bus, and that'll take us to the bivouac, which, of course, is pretty skeletal at that hour in the morning. And gradually throughout the day, the trucks that have gone by surface, by road, will arrive and set up and be ready and prepare to receive the competitors as they arrive.
Got it.
So it's just a leapfrog, leapfrog, just catch up. And that's just the routine for 2 weeks, non-stop.
And when you do the commentary, do you have access to like footage, or are you just basically talking to the riders and finding out what the hell happened out there?
I find out what happened throughout the day as the stage is unfolding. and then you get the results. Then literally 15 minutes before I do the voice over the program, I will see the pictures of the cars and the bikes. Right, you know, look, go and stand over the editor's shoulder. How have you edited today's section? Well, I've done it, I don't know, the winner first, second place next, third place next. The next day he might do it BMW and then all the Volkswagens and then all the other competitors together. Other days he might go in reverse order. 10th overall, 9th overall, leader over. It just, you have to play around a bit. And I've got a knack of looking at TV pictures at maybe 3 times speed and going, okay, right. And as long as I know what's going to be the final picture, then it fits. Then I'm happy to voice it. And when I voice it at 3:45 rally time. And that is the international feed commentary that is taken, or goes at least, to 190 separate television stations all over the world. And when I voice it, it's voiced at the same time as it's going out on the satellite. So I've only got one chance to voice it. There's no, oh, can we just rewind and do it again? It's all in one go. If the television channel chooses to keep my voice, fine. If it doesn't and it wants to revoice it because it's maybe in Spain or Italy or Norway or wherever, fine, they can put their own voice on. But at least I've given them a guide commentary as to what has happened today, why we're looking at these pictures, and other information, together with a script that gets emailed to those 190 television stations.
Wow, cool.
And when I've done that, I then go and work, do the Versus stuff, you know, stand-ups, interviews with drivers, riders, voiceover for the Versus television program, bikes and cars.
Cool. What stands out from this particular Dakar? Besides, like, okay, I don't want to talk about the Tacoma thing anymore, but...
No.
You know.
What stands out? I thoroughly enjoyed it from a personal point of view. It was the hardest work I've ever done from a personal point of view, but that was very satisfying to know that I could work at that level for that length of time. And it was not very exciting in the bikes because it was a runaway win, and we knew that it was a runaway win even 2 or 3 days in.
Right.
But the cars were tight, close, and then they got closer and closer and closer and closer, and eventually the cars was a gap of 2 minutes and 12 seconds at the finish line, which is not a lot, is it, after 14 days of rallying and 5,300 miles or whatever it was.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I worked it out as 0.08 of a percent difference.
Oh, nice. That's amazing.
So not even a tenth of a percent was the difference of 2 minutes and 12 seconds on the finishing accumulative time of Carlos Sainz.
Do you think there was a little bit of a team order going on to let Sainz have his Dakar win?
No.
No?
No. VW were nervous because... Sainz crashed out 3 days before the finish in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
But Nasser Alatia, who I'm reasonably close with, he pretty well intimated to me that he had a contract with no team orders. So he could do exactly what he wanted, which is rare to hear nowadays. But that was quite apparent in between the lines as the rally then came to its last couple of stages. Because he was just going flat out.
He was really going flat out. I know, but there was so much, I guess, rumination about it. It's good. I mean, you know, if Volkswagen is going to have a winner, they may as well just let him go.
Yeah, but they're, for all the right reasons, you know, ultra organized, and they don't want to have a mess up, and they don't want board members on the phone to the team boss, Chris Nissen, saying, why did you not have a 1-2-3 and we've only got a bloke in second place because there's a screw up somewhere? It could have happened. The Dakar is like that. You can't just think, oh, well, we're 1-2-3, let them race and it'll all work out.
Right.
It's an evil rally. It's an evil thing. And there can be a rock and a dip and just over the next crest and it'll have you. It's evil. Somebody went out on the last stage or something. I mean, it's just not fair. Yeah, that was just a thrash down the side of some agricultural fields.
Ouch.
And something went wrong.
Ouch.
It's not fair, that rally, and it brings out a lot of emotion in people because they are just worn out and emotional. You know, I mean, I was emotional because I was so happy to see Jonas Street get to the line because he didn't get finished last year, and he's such a lovely guy, and I think it's fantastic that team with their resources and the crew that they've got around them, did get to the finish, because it's a bit of a David and Goliath job, that. Fair play to them.
There was a couple of privateer teams that did really well.
I mean, you know, it's going to be a fantastic rally next year because they've got all these 450s that will be on a level playing field, and they've got KTM will be there with a 450, Aprilia, they were top 450 this year, Yamaha close on their tail, BMW nearly won a stage and would have been maybe top five had the bloke not fallen off. And Sherco, this new team from France that won the first stage.
Right.
So that all of a sudden you got five manufacturers, which is pretty healthy. Pretty healthy for bit of a wacky sport at the end of the day. The rest of the World Cup doesn't get any coverage, does it? It's only the Dakar that gets the focus.
Right. It's really a shame that we, especially in the States, get so little of it, because we were getting basically half an hour chunks. Some of them got preempted by some other shows. In fact, the last one, the Versus thing got preempted by some stupid basketball show, and so it actually came on like 30 minutes later, and my DVR didn't account for it, so I didn't even get to see the last one. I was really bummed. I did get to see it eventually, but I was bummed that day.
Well, at least it's on, because you know, you could go back to the old days
and exactly
2 weeks after the rally, which is all of it.
Or falling just on the web. Are you coming to Laguna?
No, not at the moment. Not at the moment. Can't see that happening. Budget won't stretch, but I mean, maybe somebody will open the drawer and go, "Oh, look, there's the budget." But I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, we'll definitely see you in Indy then, right?
I'll see you at Indy, and I'm sure we'll have a chat before then. That won't be a problem.
Excellent.
But, should be a good season. Old Lorenzo's, you know, up for it, and they've got their new livery being launched in Sepang when 4th of February.
Yeah.
So there'll be all the pictures online. So that'd be interesting. I hope that Fiat Yamaha maybe looks a little bit different. It needs a bit of a spruce. There's nothing wrong with it, but they've had it for a couple of years.
Yeah, exactly.
They need to give it a bit of a spruce.
Yeah, for a while we had like the blue, then the yellow, and then, you know, then they just standardized. I really loved my favorite Fiat
livery
was at Valencia in 2005 when they were white.
Arbath, similar to when they had it in Australia, was it? Red and white?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It looked very, very, very. I like that kind of minimalistic look.
Sure. Can't picture it for a minute. I'll probably put the phone down and go and Google it.
Oh, you know what it was? It was the Bumblebee, except instead of the yellow, they used white.
Bumblebee, instead of the yellow, they used white.
You know, like the Yamaha 50th anniversary?
Oh, the red and white one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did the launch for that on the Friday night or something or other. Ah. Yeah. A couple of topless girls came on stage. That surprised us all. they were body painted in like leathers, and Ago was there with Valentino, Colin, and everything. Yeah, white bike, red checkers down the side of it.
That's what it was. You're right.
Yeah. Yep. 2005, I think that was.
Yes.
the year before Nicky won the championship. So it was a Gulwar's bike or something or other, but they had the last race was, as you say, that Fiat colour scheme. Bike leapt the fence in qualifying and nearly hit a marshal. Nearly hit Stefan Evans.
Oh, really?
Valentino fell off on Saturday afternoon and the bike leapt the fence and landed on the service road in the infield.
Oh, my God.
Very nearly hit Stefan Evans, who was, of course, their Yamaha motocross guy.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that would have been a bit of a disaster. But, that was another reason for why Valentino Rossi doesn't get on with Valencia.
He just does not. Does he?
He just does not at all. But no, it should be good. Casey will be back on form, and here and now, you'd be a fool to not bet against Casey. Let's hope that Nicky can ride that bike, because man, does he need some good results? Because we're a bit. I mean, this is the nicest possible way. We're a bit fed up of going to his debriefs and him being head in his hands, because we all know he can ride a bike. He's a world champion, for crying out loud. So that'll be great to see him back. And of course, we look forward to the Yamaha PR videos. How can they top the Laguna Yamaha USA office meet?
That was pretty good.
It was pretty funny, wasn't it? Yeah, we got a long way to go to beat that one.
And of course, all the newcomers. I mean, we got Simoncelli. I'm really excited to see what Simoncelli can do, and Hiroshi.
Bautista. Yeah, Bautista's got some work to do on the Suzuki because they haven't had a great time.
No,
Hiroshi will go very well indeed. Hopefully, the Japanese will give him some good bits, so that Honda will be a half decent Honda, not a bit of a, you know, oh well, that'll do Honda, which they can sometimes do. You know, the last couple of Grand Prix we did over the 2009 season, Tom Jojic came up and helped us in the commentary box, and he was very good, because he had that engineer's eye and he could see things that mere mortals can't see when the bike's going round, and came up with some logical stuff. And he's going to be the crew chief for Hiroshi Aoyama, so that's going to be good to see him there. And Ben, let's get him in MotoGP full-time, reigning World Superbike champion. Let's see what he can do after that brilliant result he had in Valencia. So, and Simoncelli, you know, how much carbon fiber bill is he going to rack up?
Well, you know, I think Grassini is the perfect team for him because Fausto has had an amazing effect on riders in the past. He was able to kind of get Sete from a crasher to a, you know, basically a championship contender.
They got Sete from a bloke who lost his teammate at the previous race and then died in hospital 3 days before that South African Grand Prix, and then he won it.
I know.
Don't forget that. I'm not criticising, but you have to remind yourself how strong Sete was in that hugely difficult time. There were some people coming to that South African race who didn't know that Kato had died.
Oh my God.
It was that recent. I told Tom O'Kane, who was the Mulan's chief engineer the past few years at Suzuki, I remember telling him in the paddock, you know, he just didn't know because he was traveling and all this.
Right.
He was hugely raw that weekend. And Sete won that race. I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
I know.
So, yeah, hopefully, amazing. As you say about Grassini, hopefully they can do something with old Simoncelli. Super sick.
Yeah, because he also put Melandri. Melandri was a crasher before he went to Grassini as well, and then he had a great season on that bike. So, you know, he was second, granted very far behind Rossi, but he did hit that second place so in the championship.
Mm. Yeah. Melandri, he was a crasher when he was on that Fortuna Grey Tech 3 Yamaha.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, that thing he just couldn't get on with. I remember I got on a flight once in Australia, going back after the race, and he'd fallen off the thing again. And Melandri was on his own, and he took his rucksack off one shoulder, and he was so injured he couldn't even put his rucksack in the overhead locker.
Ugh.
I mean, the poor guy, he looked so pathetic, and there's no other word for it. But I said, Marco, what are you doing? So I grabbed this rucksack and put it in the overhead locker. And he was like, oh, thank you, Toby. I said, Mark, you've just fallen off a motorcycle at about 150 miles an hour. Don't apologize. This is like Monday morning at 10 o'clock in the morning, and he only fell off the thing 18 hours earlier. Oh, he's such a hard cookie. So, yeah, he needs to get some results.
Oh, I'm sure he will, though.
Mm.
He's gotten the fire again, I think.
Mm, I hope so, because he's such a cracking guy. He's so genuine.
Yep. Yeah, totally.
So, should be good. Long way off, April, whatever it is, 11th, but it'll be good. It'll be good. We'll be in Qatar, so it'll be great to see them roll out of pit lane for that first practice under those lights.
Always exciting.
Oh, it'd be fantastic. Can't wait.
You're working with Julian again, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Excellent. Well, looking forward to that. We're going to be listening to you guys.
And I'll see you trackside at Laguna, but we're not at Laguna, Indianapolis. But we'll speak before then.
Okay, cool, man.
Okay,
thanks very much. Have a good evening.
Keep up your good work, sir.
All right, ciao.
Bye.
Okay, hi. This is Jules Cisek from MotoGPOD, and I'm on the phone with Simon Pavey. Simon Pavey is a Dakar racer, and he was also I think he gained some fame when he was in the Dakar in 2006 with Charlie Borman. They made a really great series about it called The Race to Dakar. And you also prepped Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman when they went on their long way round trip back in 2004, correct? Or 2003?
That's right, yep. It's kind of where it all started, I suppose. Yep.
Welcome to the show, and it's great to have you. We're doing a special about Dakar today, so we'll talk about that. But first, I just wanted to introduce the listeners to you a little bit more to you. So you've done seven Dakars?
Yeah, seven Dakars. I started 98 was my first one, back in the day, I suppose. And just a very much privateer the first time, and always been a privateer, like a real privateer the first time, you know, no spare parts, no mechanic, none of that, just a backpack and an XR600.
Wow.
And now I've feel very fortunate. You know, I've been seven times and I've got five finishers medals, so pretty proud of that, really.
You finished five of them?
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
Wow.
I've kind of had the full experience, really, because I finished five and I broke down once. So I've sort of had a mechanical failure and I've crashed once and ended up in the in the hospital. So I've sort of done it all ways.
Ouch. And you also run a school for off-road. You train people to ride off-road, and I guess on pretty much anything from small dirt bikes to like the big BMWs, correct?
Yeah, well, I mean, our school, we started in 2000, and it's an off-road school for anyone that's interested in off-road bikes, but a lot of our customers are people that are thinking about traveling or doing big trips and, you know, maybe haven't even been off-road before, and we very much run it as a school. It's a curriculum program, takes you through from beginning to end, and as you say, everything from we're mainly working with BMW, but now BMW's got a great range because we've got 450 enduro bikes right up to the 1200 GS Adventures, and something for everyone. It's a fantastic way to earn a living, really. Quite lucky there as well.
Very cool. Where is the school?
We're based in South Wales, which is in the UK. Yes, in South Wales, and we sort of ended up here really because of the school, because we looked at venues all over the UK and we found this fantastic site here, which is nearly 4,000 acres private land, and it's an area they use for the World Rally Championship when it comes here. So the fantastic thing is we've got really good variety of terrain, again suited to all kinds of bikes and rider abilities, all within one site, and it's a very good all-weather site in that even when the weather's really bad, it's very well drained and very good ground surface, so it's perfect for teaching. And, we've had customers in the last couple of years literally from all over the world, which is fantastic, even a few from your side of the water, believe it or not.
Excellent. How do you get sand over there?
Sand's the one thing we don't have, but we have got mud.
I know you have mud. I've seen the mud.
Yeah, we haven't got any sand, I'm afraid. I'd love to have some, but it all gets washed away.
Right. So
in the rain.
One of the main reasons I wanted to talk to you is I just really wanted to get a down and dirty view of what the Dakar was really like to compete in. Because I think the race of the Dakar I watched a couple of years ago, and I was blown away because, especially in America, we get such a small amount of TV coverage of the Dakar. We get like 30, minute highlights every day. Even now, the rest of it is just gathering stuff on the net and seeing photographs, and it looks very glamorous and they always pick like the most beautiful shots for the photographs, and you never really see just how gritty the Dakar is and what you have to put up with, like in terms of you're sleeping in these bivouacs and these tents and overnight. So tell me about what, like, the first time you went out there, you didn't have a crew at all. You really literally just went by yourself with a backpack.
Yeah, and the first year, I mean, if you think back to 98, I know it doesn't sound that long ago, but the stuff we take for granted now, the information that you can gather and, you know, the internet and cell phones and sat phones and GPS and all that, there wasn't anything. And that was exactly the problem, was that there wasn't any information. And for me, I'd actually been racing off-road since I was, you know, since I was a kid. And I had literally raced enduros all around the world. You know, I was a fairly experienced enduro rider.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to Dakar and I was completely clueless. I was like an absolute beginner. I had no idea what was going on, and I literally stumbled from one disaster to another. and all that stuff that, as you say, you get tiny little snippets of on the TV these days or on the internet. But yeah, where do you sleep? And I remember the first year I didn't have a tent or anything. My sleeping bag got stolen halfway through the rally, so I had to borrow one off KTM. And
are you serious?
You don't know any. Yeah.
Wow.
You just don't know any of that stuff. You know, I just kind of rolled up with my dirt bike and a box and a set of riding gear and thought I was off to do another enduro. But Dakar is like no other event, and that's what's so magical about it. On a completely different tier. And
is it because, you know, of the length?
It's so long. It's absolutely so long. You know, you're racing for two, it depends a little bit every year, but two and a half weeks, sometimes even 3 weeks racing. And also, not just that, the length of the days. You know, for your normal privateer guys, you can expect to be on the bike 12 hours every day for sure. And you know, they really don't. You don't get that message on the TV because they sort of show the racing special. But what they don't mention is that then you've got another 400-kilometer liaison at the end of the special stage, and that. I mean, it's what makes it a great event as well, because it's a huge adventure. And get up on, you know, all you're doing is riding and racing all day, which is sort of what we love to do. So you know. It's your only thought in your mind for 2.5 weeks as you get up before dawn every morning, try and get enough carbs down your throat that you can survive till the evening, and you never can. And then you get on your bike, fill your camel back up, and you go. And then you get back in the evening, and your only mission is to get some more carbs down your neck and get a few hours sleep and get up and go again. And that's kind of becomes your life for 2.5 weeks, which is obviously incredibly taxing, but sort of pretty special and fulfilling. There's nowhere else you can do that or where you would do that. You'd never, if you just went out riding for yourself for 2.5 weeks, you'd never put yourself through that much riding.
Right, right.
There's a whole season of racing, in, you know, compressed into a fortnight.
Amazing. And how did you do that first year?
It's still one of my best results, to be honest. Yeah, I finished, and I think I was 40th overall. I just stumbled from one disaster to another. And I think, like everyone does the first year they go, I thought I was really good at this the first few days, and trying quite hard and racing quite hard. And my lucky break, in a crazy way, was I had a massive crash on, I think it was about the seventh day, huge crash, split my helmet open, about Whoa. 2 inches all down the back.
Wow.
Knocked myself stupid, completely made a big mess of the bike. But I was actually lucky because I wasn't actually injured. You know, I was bruised and battered, but not injured.
Mm-hmm.
And the bike was such a mess, I then had to nurse the bike for 3 days because, again, I had no mechanic, no spare parts, and it was in the middle of the marathon stage anyway. And so it kind of calmed everything down for me, if that makes sense.
Sure, like kind of brought the whole thing back to earth.
Yeah, and it just became, wow, I'm in the middle of the Sahara on my own on a motorbike. I better get to the other end of this or I'm going to die out here.
Yeah.
And then, as it turned out, I then ended up on a drip 2 days later because I got really badly dehydrated and spent the rest day plugged into a drip. And wow. Just as I say,
but you went on. But you went on.
And I went on, yeah.
That's great. And you finished it. That's amazing.
And then, yeah. And when you get to, you know, after you go for all that. I mean, I had another day that same year. I ran out of fuel and, you know, it took me 4 hours to pump some fuel off someone else and got in at midnight. And, you know, just I rode one night because, again, because of my crash, I'd smashed all the lights off the bike. So I had no lights. And then I had to ride like 4 hours in the dark trying to ride beside some lunatic in a 4x4 that was all out of control. If you imagine trying to ride in the dark next to a Robbie Gordon.
Oh, God.
Sharing his headlights. It's not good.
Ouch. Ouch.
And, yeah, and then you sort of go for all of that. And then, you know, as I say, very eventually, very lucky, and as well, I would say, probably a little bit dogmatic, got to Dakar, and, you know, you're crying your eyes out because you've achieved something that you can't believe you could do.
Yeah, I remember even at the end of the race to Dakar thing, you guys got pretty emotional over there. I mean, it must every time, even if you've done it a few times, I'm sure that you're. It's such a. I mean, it's almost unfathomable that that you guys do this stuff. You know.
Oh, it's huge, and you know, you sit back here and you talk about it, and you can't kind of put yourself back in that mental place, which is probably why you go back.
Are you going back?
Yeah, of course. There was a time when I used to say no, never again, but I've learned that I'm just lying.
Right on.
So now I figure if I say, yeah, I'll go back, then maybe I won't. But no, I'm definitely up for a go. It was very hard this year watching it on the... It's probably this year's the first year for me for a while when I've not been doing it, when I haven't had a reason, like I'm not doing it, like another project. The only reason I wasn't there this time was, you know, I didn't have the money and couldn't find the sponsors. And so I'm just sitting there getting incredibly. I spent the whole 2 weeks just looking for Toby's Twitters and,
yeah, exactly.
Whatever bits of information you could glean from the net. And as you say, it's quite amazing because there is a hell of a lot of information compared to what there was 10 years ago, but it's still just get these little snippets, don't you? A little taste. And
we definitely would love to see
more.
Yeah.
You want more.
Yep. What did you think of this year's Dakar? I mean, the bike part, I think, was kind of, you know, decided kind of by penalties almost, you know. And Depres got away really well, and then he rode very safely for the rest of the thing. But, you know, was there anything that stood out for you? Definitely the switch to the smaller bikes is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, what happened with 450s and what's going to happen. I think everybody's a little bit into the sport is sort of interested to know. I'm still not quite sure what to make of that myself, in all honesty. I think, you know, there's pros and cons to it. And, you know, there's obviously other people that are creating those rules that have got an agenda. But, you know, with the lead of the race, with Cyril and Mark, you know, those two, they're so close. If you look at every rally this year, it's whichever one of them makes a mistake, the other one wins. And
right.
It's kind of been the pattern all through the year. And, you know, Cyril had exactly the same thing in the last round of the World Championship this year, where he did what Coma did in Dakar. You know, he got done for a speeding penalty and lost the race.
Yep.
It's just that close for those two. And you look down through the rest of the field, there's some awesome riders there, but those two are just on their own level, really.
I want to ask you a kind of a difficult question. So, you know, Mark Coma got hit with that 6-hour penalty because of the tire change, the supposed tire change. And one of the stories that I read, it was a very interesting story on some bike blog or something, is that it actually happens a lot that there's kind of bending rules and not following the rules to the spirit of the law and all that kind of stuff. And basically that he just got caught, and that it actually happens a lot. Does it really happen a lot?
Yeah, I think, it's a French run race, you know, so the rules are there until they're not there. And it was one of the things I kind of had to learn, you know, the first time I went to a few of these French run events, and it's just sort of the way they are. And you have to take the good with the bad with that, because at the end of the day, there's no one else other than the French that can run those kind of crazy races. It's the same as with, you know, with the sailing world, isn't it? They're the only ones that can kind of run those events, because
they're the only sort of Western nation that hasn't got their knickers in a twist about health and safety and regulation. So they just sort of get on with it.
That's a good
point.
They've
got their rule book, but yeah.
That's a good
rule
point. They've got the Tour of the France, for example, is another one.
Exactly. People fall off cyclists taking drugs. But yeah, they're taking drugs, but it's kind of, as long as they're not getting caught, it's all right. Oh, they got caught, we chuck them out. You know, it's just, it is sort of the French way, but it's why they can still run the Dakar, because when you look at that race, it is quite amazing in our modern world where we're all wrapped up in cotton wool that they can't even run that event, but they do.
I know. I was really worried when they did that cancellation that it was basically done.
Everybody was.
Yeah.
And yeah, the French are great for that, to be honest with you. It's kind of what you have to love to hate and about them. And say the rules, it's just, if you talk, we had a couple of my other instructors raced in Dakar this year, so they've just got back. And two opposite ends of the spectrum, because we had Tamsin Jones, who's second British woman to ever finish. So she finished this year, her first Dakar.
Uh-huh.
And but she, she finished like right at the back, had all the big dramas, and arriving at 2:30 in the morning, and bike falling apart, and crashes, and all the great stories. And on the other end of the spectrum, another guy that works for us, Craig Bounds, his second Dakar, he went the first time last year, finished last year with a broken sternum, went back this year healthy, and unfortunately his engine packed up on the second last day, and he finished 18th on a stage this year, so he was really on it.
Wow.
But he was saying the same thing to me only yesterday about the rules, where there was, again, you don't see it on the telly, but there was one day where apparently a whole bunch of riders missed 3 or 4 CPs, but that day they'd knocked so many people out of the rally that day already, they kind of just turned a blind eye, and there was a bunch of people in the bivouac that he finished in front of on the special stage that day on the results, but they rode 3 hours less riding than him.
Oh man.
And again, it's just kind of like, yeah, whatever.
Right. Because really, except for the really, really top guys, most of the riders are out there just to see if they can finish. And that's the goal.
For sure.
Sure. It's not about where you finish, it's that you finish.
Exactly, for sure. And to be honest, I think, for me, the more of them I've done, the more you realize that, because again, after I went the first time, you sort of come back and you think, yeah, I can do all this better, and you go back the next time and you try to get a little bit better, but when you get home, you sort of don't care about that, and no one really cares about that. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Apart from Cyril, first place, kind of second to 92nd after that, if you've come home safe and uninjured and you've got that medal, everyone's a winner, and you're happy, and it's a very personal thing. You go out there to achieve what you can personally achieve, and to push yourself as hard as you can push yourself, and hopefully come back home safe. And if you've done all that, then I think for me, something that's fantastic that's happened with Dakar, and I know it's really controversial, is the whole thing going to South America. But I think it's been a brilliant move for the race. It's expanded the whole interest and knowledge about the event to a bigger part of the world, and the terrain they've got over there, and the variety, and the people, and all of that side of it, I think it's just been absolutely fantastic for the whole sport and motorsport and interested bikes. And I kind of hope they carry on with it. I know there's a lot of rumors about it coming back to Africa, but I actually think, just taking that brand and that concept of the world's toughest race and taking it to different countries and deserts, I think it's a brilliant move.
I think it'd be really cool if they rotated every 5 years or so, or some, even more often, and just, do Asia at one point. Although, the nice thing about this particular terrain is that they're using is, it really is, it's like a different planet. Like parts of that
Atacama.
Atacama Desert, exactly. Where it's like being on a different planet. I mean, it's unreal how strange that area is. They, you know, they don't have rainfall for like 300 years or something.
I know.
You know?
And you know, I mean, for me, obviously, my big passion's riding dirt bikes, but a big part of the reason why I sort of went over to rallies as against enduros is I love that fact that you're kind of going somewhere, you know, and it's half race and half adventure, and there's so much, so many more possibilities for it. And probably another thing people don't know about, but there was another kind of new rally that got launched about a year and a half ago, and unfortunately I only ran once. I was lucky enough to do it, and it was called Transoriental Rally, and it went very, you know, exactly the same as Dakar, same rules and all that, but just a different organizer. And it was similar. It was like 11,000 kilometers, 18 days, I think. And we went from St. Petersburg in Russia to Beijing in China. And
whoa.
It was exactly like the stuff you're saying about. It was just fantastic because you went to these places in the world that you can't believe exist. And sometimes maybe you've seen them on the telly, but it's just not the same as when you actually, you know, travel through that and you stop on the side of the road and, you know, talk to someone or go into a little cafe or, you know, and then you're just riding up. We went through these dunes in China that were 2,000 meters above sea level. I mean, you don't even realize they exist in China.
Amazing. What was that?
Algerain or...
Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right. And
I think they said it was maybe the fifth biggest desert in the world, but I kind of hadn't even heard of it.
Yeah. The world is getting smaller because of all the information, but there's still so much out there that we don't even realize is there.
Exactly.
And this is a great way to really see it.
Yeah.
I mean, I know my son and I were watching all the car highlights, and we learned so much about South America that we just didn't know, you know, like all the little cities and the fact that they have this crazy desert and you know, the passes in the Andes and all that kind of stuff. It was really, really cool.
Yeah, and the place is fantastic, and the people are so passionate. And, you know, at the end of Dakar last year, the first time, actually, my wife came over to the finish in Buenos Aires, and then we just rented some bikes and went riding for a couple of weeks after Dakar.
Wait, you were in Dakar last year?
Yeah, I rode last year. And,
tell me about that. So, hang on, you actually did the Dakar in South America. Well, we got to talk about that.
Yeah. Well, that was sort of the big, as soon as I saw it was going to South America, I was like, yep, there's my entry. And all the things I just said about it, really. It's fantastic because the variety and the terrain, and, you know, we went down into Welsh Patagonia and up into these big green prairie lands and cross farm, and really, you know, there was a lot of terrain that we rode. Like, I suppose the last couple of Dakars I did in Africa, you know, you are going places where a lot of vehicular traffic has been, both from the rally over the years and a lot of vehicles in Africa. You know, there are people driving everywhere in trucks and old junkers, whereas we were just going across this terrain where clearly no vehicles had been before. And yeah, all the stuff you saw on the telly made it incredible as well. The crowds, thousands, well, hundreds of thousands of people in the crowds, and, you know, they're jumping on the bikes and climbing all over you and putting stuff in your hands as you're riding by, and just astonishing reception from everywhere we went. And then, you know, you had all these other elements we've never had in Africa as well, like the altitude.
Exactly, right.
4,800 meters we went up to on one day, and, you know, all that sort of, I suppose for a bike rider, quite a new experience, really, and you don't sort of know quite what's going to happen. And yeah, just brilliant experience.
And you finished?
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah, finished last year. Yeah, I had a pretty good ride last year, to be honest with you. Apart from the day I rode 200 kilometers on a flat tire, that wasn't very much fun.
Oh, good.
But, yeah, the rest of it was great.
What bike did you ride?
I had a BMW G650 Cross Challenge. That's a mouthful, isn't it? 650 BMW, obviously, my little association. But, yeah, it was good.
Very cool. And then you said you rode around afterwards?
Despite my wife flew to the finish. We just rented a couple of bikes and went riding around for 8 or 9 days afterwards. And just the same, you know, had no real knowledge of Argentina, but the people were just fabulous everywhere you went, and you couldn't kind of get a better reception anywhere. And the terrain and the scenery is just, yeah, I suppose you just don't quite know, do you? We're flooded with so much sort of touristic information when we live in the parts of the world we live in, but you get little pockets that you don't actually find anything about because they're not on the main resort maps.
Right. Excellent. Thank you very much, and take care of yourself, right?
Thank you. Yep, thanks for your time, and yeah, hopefully speak to you again soon.
All right, cheers. Ciao.
Bye.
Hey, it's Jules Cisek for MotoGP OD, and I'm here with Azhar Hussain, who's the founder of the TTX GP race that we had last year at Isle of Man, and also at Mid Ohio. Was not really a race, right?
No, Mid Ohio. Jules, and hello, listeners.
Oh, hello.
Mid Ohio was an exhibition event. It was really something that the AMA really wanted to make happen, and there's a really nice guy, a vice president there called Rob Razor, who invited us to come, and so we did, and it was really to show the AMA membership and others what electric motorcycling could look like, and so it was just an exhibition lap, so that's really with thanks to the AMA.
Cool. So we're going to have you on the show in a few weeks, but we wanted to talk about something very special that you're doing with the TTXGP, which is this whole... You seem to be an embracer of technology, so why don't you tell us about what you're going to do?
Right, so, well, we have done it now. What we decided to do is for the 2011 racing season, we have established a wiki for the rules. So at egrandprix.com/wiki, our current rule set is up there, and we literally invite anybody who knows anything to come and be part of it and to contribute to how the racing should look like for 2011. So the format of it is that the wiki is being moderated by a lawyer, Harry Mallon, who's a long-time EV enthusiast, and he has a legal mind. So he's looking through this and making sure that it's intellectually credible and is consistent, and, you know, not just spammed to death, but there's some sensible ideas hopefully going through. The idea is that in 6 months' time, we'll close the wiki down, and we'll take all the ideas and everybody's contribution and pass them through a filtering process with the technical committee. Mm-hmm. That will filter for things like safety, for competitiveness, for legality, I mean, just practicality, I mean, just a bunch of things that rules have to meet. But essentially is this: if it's a good idea and we can put it in, we will. And then for 2011, you'll have a rule set which has been created by the people who are going to be running with it. And in 2011, we'll start the process again for 2012. And
very cool.
The idea is, I mean, what's really driven this is the fact that the technology is moving way too fast for any single individual or even group of individuals to know what's going on. So you have two dimensions here. One is the pace of the technology. The second dimension is the spread of it. It's happening everywhere. I mean, there's a whole amount of work happening in Asia. There's a whole amount of work happening in Europe. Clearly a lot of work happening here in North America. So today, the way rules are put together in motorsports, you'll have a committee of people who are, you know, typically from one part of the world, who are of a particular culture and outlook and everything else. But what they decide governs the entire world of racing for that particular sport. And our technology is just moving too fast for any one individual to know what's going on. So if you want to have a race in China or in Malaysia or in India, which are major motorcycle markets and huge amount of enthusiasm there, well, those people are not on any rule-making committees now for any international championship. So we want to include them. We want to create an environment and a mechanism to engage with that audience. So the wiki is our attempt to do that. We started with the wiki. We'll see how that goes. Later on, I want to try and expand the program beyond just the internet to maybe consultations on the ground during our racing calendar. Perhaps as an argument to move into other languages, because currently everything's in English. So I'm interested in trying all these things out. TTHGP can only exist if we stay at the leading edge of technology, competitiveness, and be inclusive in what we're trying to do. And if we are to do that, we've got to embrace diversity and speed in a way which perhaps current motorsports hasn't really lent itself to.
Are these technical rules, or are they also like rules for rider behavior and all that kind of stuff? Like, you know,
that's interesting. They're technical
rain,
rules.
All that kind of stuff.
No, right, yeah. Now they're technical rules. And there's a reason for that, because when you go to some of these, a lot of countries have their own sanctioning bodies. As an international championship, I have a huge amount of control over the technical part of the rules, as in what people are manufacturing. But the riders are governed by a separate licensing system and a system of how they behave. And that is typically held by the local sanctioning body. So if you have an AMA license, well, there'll be a body of rules that you'll adhere to get that license and so on. If you're in the UK, there's the ACU and they have their own. And if you go to Italy, the FMI have their own and so on and so forth. So this is really about the technology. And that's really what our focus is. And one of the things we're very keen on doing is we want to have one rule set for the world. Because we want to reduce the cost of racing. We want to reduce the increased accessibility to be part of it. And for that, we need to get scale. So if you build a bike for any of our championships, that bike has to be eligible for any of our other championships. And it has to be eligible on a global. This is a global industry. So the idea of having rules which are open and allow people from many parts of the world to contribute achieves two goals. A, it means that we get to hear or know about stuff which is happening now, and we can look to see if we can accommodate it. But secondly, it makes those people part of the process. And we can share ownership of the rules, and it's easy for them to adopt. It's very hard for someone to complain that they don't have, they don't agree with what's going on if they were part of what form, the rule set they're running. So that's what it is. So motorcycles, for motorcycles in particular, but for motorsports in general, I think it's a very exciting moment. And it's a great experiment, and I don't think anybody could predict how it's going to turn out. But the prize is well worth the effort, and I'm incredibly pleased that TTHGP is the first motorsport series to really give this a go and see what happens. And
you know
what? If it doesn't work, we can go back to what we were doing.
Sure, I guess so. Yeah, sure. Last year, one of the things that really blew me away when you did the Mission Motors event was how many people showed up who were just, you know, enthusiasts and they like build their own bikes.
Right.
They do their own conversions to electric motors.
That's
and
right.
Stuff. And so they know a lot. These people know a lot.
So last year when we did the premiere of our TTHGP DVD at Mission Motors and we gave you guys a sample of what the movie looked like, and we had that event, and the cross section of people who came to that event is indicative of the kind of people we're attracting, which isn't just about motorcyclists. It isn't just about technologists. It isn't just about people who care about the environment. It isn't just about people who love about speed. It's all of those people, and people we never expected to come. So if you look at the diversity of our crowd, diversity of the people who are following us, it's showing that TTHGP is a breakout phenomenon. I mean, everything we've achieved has been because of partly of some stuff that we've done, but we don't exist in a vacuum. We exist as part of a larger system. And that larger system has a tremendous amount of goodwill and tremendous amount of interest in driving this forward. And those other parties are currently not engaged with motorsports.
Right.
And they're currently not engaged with the governing bodies. If the governing body had a list of people who they would call to get an opinion, these people are not on that list. Right? And coming back to the wiki, one of the ideas of the wiki was to try and identify individuals or groups or places where there was a particular hotbed of expertise. Because quite honestly, nobody knows where that is now. I mean, we think we know, but we don't know. And if you define the solution by what you think you know, you kind of define how it's going to go. So your preconceptions affect the outcome, and which is not where we want to be, really.
Cool. Well, good luck with this project. I think it's very courageous, and I think it could turn the whole thing on its head in a good way.
I love it. One thing I'd like to ask is for your listeners, if you are a technical expert, if you love motorsports, if you're engaged or just interested, this is your chance to be part of TTSGP. It's a very real, tangible way your contribution will make an effect of what we'll ride, what we could be driving riding tomorrow. Motorsports has a direct connection with what appears on the road. I mean, motorsports is an expensive business, and it's affected by very real market dynamics. So manufacturers get involved with that, partly for the PR, partly for all that, but that's not the only game, right? Partly it's because they need a testbed and a development. And motorsports is a little bit like R&D on steroids. It's everything is accelerated, and you learn. And so, but whatever happens on the track is governed by the rules. The rules are at the core of all of this. And if you understand the rules and you understand how to make the changes, well, we want to hear from you. We want to work with you, and we'd like you to be part of what we're doing.
Cool.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. And we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Cheers.
Great. Thank you very much to Toby Moody again, Simon Pavey, and Azhar Hussain for talking to us. And we've got a bunch of links for you guys in the show notes. We've got Toby sent in some photos that he took at the car, so we'll post those. And obviously the link to the wiki and the link to Love, Speed, and Loss and to Toby and Simon's website, so you can go check those out. And that's it for this week. Hope you enjoy the show.
Yeah, things are starting to hot up. Remember, this weekend we've got Supplang firing up for MotoGP, its first test of the year.
Dear Lord, is it this weekend?
Yes, it is.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Good morning.
Wow. Yeah.
And I've been on my tippy toes all week, just, you know, after we had all the stuff from last weekend at Portimao, you know, I kind of came down off that high, but I'm like, oh yeah, it's like 5 days away and we're straight back into it again. So,
I am so disconnected. I can't believe I forgot that it was this weekend.
I could have given you a heart attack, sir.
Well, fantastic. All right. Well, great. Well, by the time that you're listening to the show, there's probably going to be some results already coming in.
Maybe we'll have some cool stuff to, you know, Photoshop stuff to show off by them too.
Yes, there you go. All right. Thanks very much, everybody. Thanks, Jim. Take care. Ciao.
Ciao.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them. The MotoGP OD podcast was created by Bob Hayes. It is co-hosted by Jules Cisek and Jim Race. The website was built by Simon Roberts. Music by Jules Cisek. Jim Race deals with public relations. And the podcast is produced by Jules. And today's episode was brought to you by the letter X.